You are listening to Friends of Europe's podcast. Don't miss our debates on global and European issues that span political, economic, social, and environmental challenges, and follow our website at friendsofeurope.org.
A special hello to the Young China Watchers who are here again with us today. I'm Shada Islam. I'm Director of Policy at Friends of Europe. And we're delighted to have with us today two senior Chinese academics who've been very closely involved in the and who will explain to us the ins and outs of this document. Let me introduce first Professor Cai Feng. He's Vice President of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, CAS, who we all know here very well. And he's a member of the advisory board of the 13th Five-Year Plan on National Economic and Social Development of China. He's published extensively on the Chinese economy. We also have with us today, thank you very much for coming, Professor Yao Zhejiang. He's Deputy Director of the Institute of World Economics and Politics at CAS. And he's also published several papers and books on the Chinese economy and the world economy. Now, there's a great deal of interest in this new Xi San Wu, and that's no surprise. China matters. We all know that. China matters to the Chinese citizens, but also China matters to the world, and of course to the European Union. Now, the new plan, we all know, comes at a very important time in China's economic transformation and change. There are three characteristics of what's happening at the moment in China, Professor, that interests us here in Europe. Of course, the focus of newspaper headlines is on the devaluation or not of the RMB, about the flight of capital, market volatility, and we just wonder to what extent that really links to the real economy of China. China is, of course, involved in a massive rebalancing of its economy, from exports and investments to consumer services and services. And of course, there's the wider question that we all have here about China's new normal. What does it really mean in terms of what's happening on the global landscape? The new plan is, of course, also President Xi's master plan, if you like. It's his leadership that set it in place, in motion. And the questions we have is, which are the key areas? We know it's innovation. We know it's green development. But what does that actually mean in practice? The second question I think that we all have here is also, we've just had an agreement on Agenda 2030, the Sustainable Development Goals, and on COP21 as well. How will that link up to this new master plan as well? And finally, we all think about our own interests, of course. So what's in it for us? What's in it for European industry, if you like? Now, just to say to you that we have the notes of Professor Cai Feng's intervention, so you have it with you. He's going to speak in Chinese, so I would advise you all to start putting your headphones on. And in a second, Professor, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Shada. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming today. Before we begin our dialogue, I would like to take this opportunity. I think most of you have my PowerPoint slides with you, so I would like to give you a brief introduction about China's 13th five-year plan. First, when we talk about 13th five-year plan, what does that mean? That means for the domestic economic growth and development of China. That means that's the 13th five-year plan, so we have 12 ahead of it. So we actually begin five-year plan in 1953. That's the year when we have the first five-year plan. But there's one thing I have to remind you, that in the 90s, we are pretty sure about our future reform direction, that we are going to build a socialist market economy, which means we'll be lead straight from planned economy. So if we don't want to have a planned economy anymore, why do we need this plan? So I have to explain to you that actually since the 11th five-year plan, in Mandarin, we have changed the word plan. Before, we call it plan, 计划. Now we call it 规划. 规划 is more like a project or blueprint. So it's no longer plan. I think in English, it will be similar to layout or blueprint rather than plan. It's not planned anymore in Chinese. So you have to realize this. Secondly, how do we come up with the five-year plan? First is at the end of the last year, or at the last year of the previous five-year plan, for the Communist Party in China, they will come up with the next five-year plan for the next 5 years. So this is basically some suggestions, but that's actually guidelines for the next five-year plan. So from there, we will come up with a more comprehensive five-year plan guidelines, basically led by the State Council. So State Council will prepare a guideline for the next five-year plan in the final year of previous five-year plan. So currently, we are at the last year of the current five-year plan. So next year, we're going to have the 13th five-year from March. So every March, we are having the National People's Congress. So in National People's Congress every March, we are going to review the next five-year plan, whether we will ratify it or not. So when I return to China after Chinese New Year, we are going to work on the National People's Congress, and we will have a King debate and discuss, and finally we will pass the final five-year plan for the 13th five-year plan, which will come into effect this March. If you heard the song of the 13th five-year plan, and then you will feel it's quite special. Why I would say 13th five-year plan is special? There are several special characteristics make it different from previous FYP. First is the timing. I think the next 5 years are crucial for China, because the Chinese government is sure that in 2020 we will comprehensively build an overall moderately well society. So whether we can achieve that goal or not in 2020, it all depends on this 13th FYP. And in the 18th Central Committee, we've also decided that we will have two doublings for both GDP and per capita income. And also, we would like to convert all the rural resident income to the GDP performance. So that's a very important, crucial goal we would like to accomplish in the next 5 years. We also know that a lot of other countries around the world, how can they evolve, become developing countries rather than underdeveloped country? Actually, they've all faced a certain difficulty or challenge, let's say it's a middle income trap. So it's a critical period for China that we can learn from all the other countries' experiences, whether we can avoid falling into this middle income trap. That's why the next 5 years is very crucial. 13th five-year plan is raised by Communist Party in China. And of course, we focus on five important concepts of development. All the policies are revolving around these five concepts. First is innovative development. Second is coordinative development. Third, greener development. Fourth one is open or opening up development. And the fifth one is shared or inclusive development. At the same time, we've also raised proposed some demands for development for the next 5 years. First, we would like to see moderately high growth for economy in the next 5 years. Before, when we come up with a five-year plan, we usually say that we would like to accomplish certain GDP growth in the next 5 years. We have a very specific figure, but this time we have no specific figure. We only mention it's going to be a moderately high growth. So what does that mean? I think moderately high growth means it is both a qualitative and quantitative goal. So we can compare the future economic growth to previous periods where we have seen 10% GDP or economic growth. Of course, we might see economic growth slowing down, and that's what we refer to as new normal. That's why we cannot call it high-speed growth anymore. That's why we give it new term, moderately high growth. And of course, I'm confident to say we're not going to grow very slowly. We're not going to see a slow growth. So at least we can see moderately high growth. And from quantitatively speaking, since we've made this goal of the two doubling goal for GDP in 2010, so what kind of demand we would like to see the GDP and economic growth for the next 5 years? We wish to see the economic growth of at least 6.53%. That will be able to call it a doubling. So with this goal, I think there are a lot of things we need to work on to be able to achieve this goal. So if we cannot have innovative development, coordinative, greener opening up, or inclusive developments, I think we might miss out opportunities and we could not realize this doubling goal. And we will fail to build a an overall moderately well society. So how can we achieve this moderately high growth? I think it's not easy. The whole world is quite concerned that since 2012, our economic growth has been going downwards. So whether we can achieve that goal of moderately high growth economically, I think I really have to introduce this concept to you, which is new normal. Under the new normal trend, I think economic growth in Taiwan will in China will keep going downwards. As an economist, I think we will focus on increasing, enhancing productivity. We've been working on predicting economic growth, that's potential economic growth. So before 2010, that's 10%. And after 2010, which we come to the 12th five-year plan, the economic growth is about 7.6%. That's a potential economic growth. So for 13th five-year plan, we're focusing on achieving 6.2% as our potential growth. So we have to make sure we do our best. As I mentioned that we wish to see a GDP doubling and achieving the goal of 6.53, I think there is a gap between 6.2 or 6.53%. So how can we achieve that? We call it reform dividend. So we have to change supply and demand relationship, and we try to have different kind of reforms. And through this reform dividend, there is a chance we can achieve all those goals. So as you can see from all the charts I provided here, if we do not have any reforms, there is no chance for us to achieve those goals. Of course, we have to enhance productivity. We have to increase the labor force. And even birth rate, how much we can increase in the long run, and whether we can enhance educational level for Chinese people. So combining all these factors, we can predict more and better potential economic growth rate. That's why I'm confident to say we can have this moderately high growth, combining the reform dividend with our potential growth rate. I'll give you an example of reform dividend. This is my specialized area. As you know that we have to register where we are from in China. So we call it hukou. What does hukou means? That means for people who were born in the rural areas, they have to register locally, so they are known as rural people. Once they become the major labor force, a lot of them go seek jobs in big cities. So those people comprise for 0.17 billion, which means they have their hukou in rural areas, but they are currently working in big cities. But they do not and they cannot obtain the city hukou. That means they cannot have any health insurance. They do not have any protections in these big cities. So if it comes to laying off, they will be the first people being laid off, become unemployed. They could not receive any basic welfare. Their children could not receive free education in those big cities. They could not enjoy those basic rights. And those actually prohibit and prevent them becoming the so-called legal citizens who can have hukou in those big cities they work in. So we are hoping to have certain reforms to turn these people's hukou into urban hukou to where they work. So I think through this reform, we can enhance the labor supply. We can also enhance productivity. And we can help labors moving among different cities. That means we can redistribute our labor forces and enhance productivity. As I mentioned to you, there are 0.17 billion of this kind of people. Once they can obtain their urban hukou of the city where they live in, I think it will actually push more consumption from those population. So I think all these reasons I just gave you can increase economic growth for China in the future. Another point I would like to point out here is for the 13th five-year plan, there are five major developments, as I mentioned earlier. What does this mean for Europe? For Europe's enterprises, for European governments. I think that means in the future, we are going to be able to provide more needs and more of our expertise in terms of education, technology, and other fields. So innovative development is really important for us, which means international cooperation, science and technology, and education. And second is coordinated development. Now China has been focusing on the central and western China, which is lagging behind in terms of economic growth. So I think that means more opportunities will be opened up for Europe or for European enterprises. Coordinated development also means that we will shift a direction from the past, which we focus on exporting. We'll be focusing on domestic consumption in the future. A third development is a greener development. Of course, we're going to work on eliminating CO2 emission, and we're going to work our part in terms of investing in more environmental protection projects. And for opening up development, of course, we always link this to open up and development, open up and reform. So in the future, I'm sure more and more opportunities will be provided for international society, especially under One Belt, One Road initiative.
Last but not least, we have this shared or inclusive development. Of course, this will help expand scale and scope of consumption.
Currently, we have a huge population, which are what we call rural population. They're still below the poverty line. As I mentioned to you earlier, that 0.17 billion people are the rural workers, rural laborers. So once we can change the hukou problem, I'm sure we can see a bigger middle income group emerging, and they will be able to consume domestically. As you can imagine, that all the products that's made in China before are labor-intensively products. In the future, we wish to focus more on technological product, or we can provide different services and work on our tourism. Those are our major focus in the future, which will provide a lot of opportunities for Europe. Thank you very much. That's my briefing.
Thank you very much indeed, Professor. Thank you very much for pointing out the opportunities and the, let's say, the theoretical development that is foreseen, but also the challenges China will face. There is a lot of expertise in this room. I'm sure there are a lot of questions coming from the participants here as well, but I'd like to kick off the discussion, if I may, Professor, by asking you just how realistic are these goals, especially the GDP growth goals, given that there is a slowdown at the moment. So what kind of pressure will this economic slowdown bear on the implementation of the new plan?
As a matter of fact, I've introduced to you about the core ideas of 13th five-year plan. There are five of them. Those five goals, they are not eternal goals, at least for a country like China. Let's say 5 years ago or 10 years ago, we do not have a vision for these five development projects, because 5 years, 10 years ago, we can just rely on the investment or labor-intensive industry to support Chinese economy. And we can obtain high-speed economic growth. Back then, go back to 11's five-year plan, we have 11.3% economic growth back then, because the whole economic growth have been slowing down. I have to focus on the slowing down again. That's not because we do not have enough external demand. That's because we have certain structural reforms and changes in China. I'll give you some example. I do care about the population, a demographic issue in China. Actually, 2010 is a turning point. Let's say the labor group, the age between 15 to 59, this labor population has to gone into negative growth from 2010. So you can imagine we do not have enough labor supply. So, of course, they will demand higher wages, and that will cause slower or negative economic growth. So that's why we're not surprised to see slower economic growth. And we have to redistribute resources, and this kind of opportunities doesn't come around easily with fewer labor population. When we are short of laborers, labor population, when you invest in certain projects, you do not see as much as good return as before. So I think it's just because China has gone through different stages and phases. That's why slowing down economy is an unavoidable fact that we've seen. Because a lot of the traditional driving factors were not there anymore. You could not maintain this high speed economic growth. So how can we focus on in the future we'll have a more moderately growth? We have to focus on our next new five developments.
Thank you very much. I would like to take questions from the floor now. Please raise your hands. I have colleagues who have their microphones with them. Please identify yourself. I'll take Ed first. Could you take the... Yep, just keep your hand up, Ed, for a second. Yeah, Leticia.
Thank you very much. Thank you. That was a fascinating overview. My question really relates to the point you made about the...
Excuse me for interrupting. Can you identify yourself?
Sorry, Ed Wells from HSBC. My question really relates to the demographic issue you raised earlier. And I guess before the financial crisis, the thing in Europe we were all very worried about was the aging population of Europe and the demographic challenge that that created to create pensions and welfare opportunities for an aging workforce. China's now beginning to think about, as you said, the negative growth of the working population vis-a-vis the rest of the population. As people live longer, they need pensions and other provision late in life. China has a fantastic savings rate. 50% perhaps of incomes are saved. So there's a huge pool of potential savings that could be mobilized for investment. But our observation might be that there aren't enough products and assets for people to invest in China. So that tends to create hotspots in property and other asset classes. What can Western institutions or foreign institutions help? How can they help China to develop those investment opportunities going forward? Will China be opening up to allow more foreign institutions to come and create new asset classes and new investment opportunities to tap that savings rate and to help China meet its demographic challenge for pensions?
对. Thank you for your question. I think, as we all know, that Europe, actually, we're seeing aging society now in Europe, so there's a lot we can learn from you. But I think for China, we have a bigger challenge that we are facing. Because for China, when we have specific different developed stages, the aging speed, the aging rate is actually more dominant and more greater than other countries and societies. So I think the aging speed is actually greater than any other developing countries. So we have a turn called Wei Fu Xian Lao, means we haven't got rich yet and we are already old. And of course, if we can have a more comprehensive pension system, because currently we have this pay-as-you-go system for the pension, when we have a less dependent population, it works. But when you have a higher dependent population, pay-as-you-go doesn't work. It's not sustainable anymore, and the huge problems will be caused to the society. But luckily, till now, yes, we do have a high savings rate, relatively speaking, comparing with other countries. Actually, yeah, we have quite a high investment rate. For most people have estate or other properties, I think the proportion to GDP is the highest in the world. So that means if you have investment, you have savings. But the main issue is where do you put your investment? Of course, as you all know, that when we used to have this advantage of manufacturing industry, when we have demand for infrastructure, most of us develop in our, put our investment in infrastructure development. However, with the disappearing of the demographic dividend, we face different kind of challenges. A lot of production is overly produced. So you can no longer invest in the same fields and areas, because all the enterprises and the companies will complain that the return rate is getting lower and lower, and we do not know where to invest. So most people can think of is that we can invest in something that has nothing to do with competitive strengths. Some people put their money in real estate market, in stock market, and in bonds, to overseas properties, or even buying European arts. Artworks like Van Gogh's paintings are very popular investment, because those kind of investment has nothing to do with the real economy. So if you wish to invest in those kind of properties, it might be bubbleized. Let's not forget about the lesson we can learn from Japan in the 90s. I think any kind of excessive demand will cause bubbleization in the future if you do not or you cannot recognize, identify where the risks and where the dangers are. That's why we recently have the Central Economic Committee Grand Meeting. We focus on that in the future, yes, we will have structural reform, especially focusing on the real economy and have more reform, more opening up for especially service sector. As I mentioned earlier, that open up and reform, these two words are linked together in China. So a lot of time I can hear European enterprises or European company complain to me that we have so many obstacles when we invest in China. And actually, you can talk to your counterparts, your Chinese counterparts. A lot of Chinese companies, they will find challenges when they try to invest in China themselves, because, yes, we do have certain restrictions. So we wish to see we can create a better environment for investors in the future through various reforms and to open up to not only medium and small enterprises in China, but also foreign medium and small enterprises. I think the most doable way is that when you view aging society is a problem, you will think it's a negative thing. But you can view it from a different perspective. There are some plus, I think. And actually, it can create a second demographic dividend for your country. For example, health, industry, tourism, those could be booming with an aging society. A lot of people in my age are already retired in China, and a lot of them are looking forward to retirement, especially those ones have good income. So they were hoping that once they retire, they can go travel in Europe, they can go travel around the world. So I think there are a lot of investment opportunities related to an aging society. And these opportunities are open up to all parties.
Thank you much, Professor. So Ed, I guess the message is hang in there. It's going to get better. Professor Yao, do you want to say a few words now? Would you like to comment on anything? And then I'll give the floor to Marjut.
I'd like to respond here. For the further open up and reforms for China, what kind of opportunities we can bring to Europe. For the 13th FYP, we have a very clear goal for opening up. That means we are going to have an open up new system economy, which means we would like to realize a more developed and opened up society, and we will play under the international rules. So currently we have an important experiment undergoing that in Shanghai, Fujian, Guangzhou, Tianjin, we've chosen these four areas to conduct open up experiment. We have free trade zones in these four areas. So we have focused on these four areas to be able to for foreign investors to conduct free trades, which means they're relatively more freely than conducting trade and business in other parts of China, which we hope to see more investment, more foreign investment in those free trade zones. I'm sure in the future we can see more opening up in China, especially for financial sectors, health sectors, and service sectors. Like Professor Tsai mentioned earlier, that health industry is something we can focus on in the future. Another thing that we can foresee is that before, the Chinese economy is driven by export. And I think in the future, we can see more balance between export and import. And probably we'll see more import than export. Before, most of the importing products are parts, or let's say the mid-level products. But in the future, we are looking forward to import more consumer goods. Chinese people are fascinated, are crazy about European brands. Another thing I'd like to mention is that in the past, we tried to attract more foreign investors. But I think in the future, we will see a more balanced investment, which means we will be walking out of China, which will see more Chinese investors investing around the world. At the same time, we will see more foreign investments coming into China. Currently, we have a 10% investment hourly, and we hope to see a more balanced situation in the future. We'll be able to attract more foreign investment in China. So a lot of Chinese investors, they're not only focusing on invest in infrastructures overseas or focusing on investing resources. A lot of Chinese investors invest abroad. They would like to see their industry will go through a very important transformation, will be able to learn some technology know-how when they have those investments abroad. So for Chinese enterprises, through investing abroad, they will be able to gain more know-how and technology and research and development, be able to enhance, upgrade themselves within China. So I think this kind of approach will happen a lot in developed countries such as in Europe and U.S. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that additional information, Professor Yao. Thank you very much indeed. Marjut, please just put up your hand. Yeah.
Thank you. Marjut Tanen, European Commission. So a couple of years ago, World Bank, together with Chinese institutions, made a report called China 2030. And this was got a lot of publicity and kind of set out a lot of measures that in view of those drafters, China should take if they would like to be a moderately wealthy society. But this was, of course, a bit later than your plan. It's 2030. And among those measures that were mentioned there, which I personally, I have followed a little bit, is what has been published on your next five-year plan, but I haven't really seen, and I would like to ask you maybe about a couple of measures, whether these are foreseen also in your five-year plan, and that is indeed the tax system, reform of the tax system, because now the local governments have a lot of costs, but they don't have the tax revenue to cover those. And there has been a lot of discussion that maybe this could be balanced so that they don't have to, for example, sell a lot of land to get the income to cover all these costs. So is this type of tax reform foreseen in the five-year plan? And secondly, China is suffering quite extensive overcapacities in many industries. And also, I haven't seen anywhere really plan to address or kind of try to tackle this overcapacity issue, and also link to that the SOE reform, the reform of the state-owned enterprises. So are these type of measures foreseen in your five-year plan? Thank you.
As you mentioned that in 2030, actually, I've participated in drafting that report. A lot of problems it mentioned, actually we have responding answers you can find in 13th five-year plan. So I would like to stress again that when you see the strategic positioning of China, of the Chinese policies, that you have to focus on different projects and plans. Like for five-year plan, you have to understand the contents of the 12th one to be able to understand the 13th one better. So I think for Chinese government, how can they make most of the income and be able to support all the expenditures? For a very long time, from 1994, we have tax reform. Since then, local governments, they have their basic responsibilities. If they want to have more budget, they have tried to have some income first. But of course, back in 1994, we are in one of those highest growing time in history. So a lot of the local governments or enterprises, they have responsibility for seeking higher GDP growth. So they cannot obtain enough grant from the central government. That's why they have to sell land, like what you just mentioned. Some of them, they do not have enough land. If they do not have enough land to sell, they could not have enough fund from the government. So as I mentioned that after 2010, 2012, economic growth has been slowing down. As one important phenomenon is that we've seen less land selling situation in China. So of course, with the real economy growth rate going down, we will have less income. With less land to sell, you will have less income as well. So for local governments, yes, they do have a huge financial gap they have to fill in.
So in 2000 now, we have a huge stimulant that investing 4 trillion.
That's when we try to encourage local governments to come up with different platform to deal with the huge debt they've accumulated over the past years. So I could say that currently in China, we've come into a new stage, which is new normal with a moderately growth rate. So for local governments, they have to really define whose responsibility to create income, to have budget, to obtain grant. Of course, I think for local government, they need to have a reasonable, stable income from taxation. And of course, there are certain expenditure responsibility will be taken by central government. They can take off some burden from the local governments. When talking about overcapacity, capacity surplus, of course, we've been addressing this issue for a while, and we've come up with certain supply and demand reform that we have to consume those overcapacity surplus. And of course, we can try to open up, be able to consume more real estate properties through urbanization. With more urban populations, we will be able to achieve this goal. Another is the leveraging, and we will be able to eliminate any debt accumulated in the past years for local government and central government. And of course, for those parties that's been having a difficult time, for those enterprises having a difficult time, we call them zombie enterprises. So from 2015, we have to do something with those zombie enterprises.
Yeah, do you want to say a few words? Perhaps later? Yeah, okay, fine. I have the gentleman over there, just behind. Yeah, in the red sweater, Leticia.
I'm Jan Jonkier from the website chinasquare.be, that is in Dutch language. I have a question about hookah policy. I see a contradiction between, on the one hand, the theory and the practice. And the theoretical, the government said last week that the cities, big cities, should grant the hookah to the migrant people and also to the graduates that have their diploma. So normally, except the very big mega cities, the hookah should be granted, says the government. On the other hand, there is an exception for the very big mega cities like Shanghai and Beijing that may have restriction to the hookah. That's on the one hand the theory, but on the other hand, the practice says that the migrant people that they migrate to the big cities, to the very rather big cities. So isn't there, let's say, a problem that in theory all cities should grant the hookah, but to the big cities where the migrants go, there is a restriction? That's my question.
The urbanization in China and the reform of the hukou system, I think they are contradictory from time to time. One of the difficulties we've been facing is that when we're loosening up the hukou system, actually we've been loosening up hukou system in rural areas, but it doesn't really matter because there are fewer work opportunities in those areas. So this doesn't mean anything. So most of migrant workers, they wish to have their hukou being relocated to the major cities. As you mentioned, a lot of them move to the major mega cities, Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou, Shenzhen, to those coastal areas. Those are the dream destinations for these migrant workers. That's their promised land. However, in the past few years, we've seen that what we call urbanization diseases. What are those? We have congested traffic in those mega cities, very serious air pollution, and those migrant workers, their living condition is not great in those mega cities. Not only they could not have a great living condition, they do not enjoy the same protection and social welfare as other local urban people who have their hukou registered in those cities. If this problem occurred 10 or 20 years ago, for those migrant workers, they do not enjoy the same benefits. It was because they suffer from a discrimination from city governments. But now, it's not down to discrimination. It's down to the financial ability of those mega cities. It's because if we want to incorporate those people into the mega city system to provide them with better benefit, health care, the city government cannot afford. That's why we've been talking a lot about this hukou reform, but we haven't done much. But I hope from now on, we will see a new trend. Of course, we will manage mega cities from a different perspective, and we hope to have better capacity for Shanghai, Beijing, Shenzhen. I would call them super mega cities. Of course, there are still some limitations, maybe not limiting the access for those migrant workers to those cities, but we might limit how many hukou we can issue to those migrant workers every year. And for smaller cities, we would focus on growing and developing those relatively smaller cities, because a lot of the coastal mega cities, they are already overly developed. If we can work locally, develop those rural cities and towns, those migrant workers, they do not have to be migrant workers. They can work locally in their hometown. And we will be able to maintain our strength of lower wages in those places, which will enhance our reform dividends and demographic dividends. In October last year, we have the fifth plenum of the Communist Party of China. When we raised this guideline for the future five-year plan, President Xi mentioned that in the past, we actually have our cities become bigger and bigger. We have people who live here for a longer time. What do we mean by people who live here for a longer time, which means we actually account those 0.17 billion migrant workers? If they live here for longer than 6 months, we account them as residents of those cities. But this is not enough. We have to change their hukou eventually. And of course, in the future, if we can grant them urban hukou, that's great. What about the percentage of people who hold urban hukou, which means they were born and bred in those cities? We're hoping to see from 37% to be increased to 38%, which means about 1.3% increase. That means we will comprise and we will have more migrant workers and grant them those hukou, urban hukou in the future. And we will be focusing on, like I mentioned, that we would like to focus on rural areas, but those places are not where the migrant workers want to be.
No. Yes, thank you.
Thank you. My name is Eva Valle. I work for the European Commission Trade Relations with China, and I have a question for Vice President Kaifang. You just said that in the last years you have been talking a lot about hukou reform, but little has happened. And in fact, we have the feeling that this is a bit in general the case for all the reforms announced in the third plenum now almost 3 years ago. Those were received very positively by the international community, the business community in general. But 2 years on, almost three, we see that very, very little has actually been implemented. And when it has been implemented, for instance, the SOE reform, the guidelines that were announced last September, there is very little in terms of opening up and of leveling the playing field for European companies on the ground. Now, my question to you is with the economic slowdown, the hiccups with the stock exchange and the pressures on the renminbi, is this all going to help as a wake-up call for the Chinese government to actually go and implement the reforms, or is it going to actually make it more difficult for fear of social unrest? Thank you.
How you judge the progress and speed for the opening up and Chinese reform? I think we should have certain evaluation system. I think a lot of scholars from China or abroad, they've been working on this evaluation system. But there are a lot of factors will affect how you judge, evaluate the system. For me, I think for the hukou system, of course, I'm not very happy with the third plenum. And I think the hukou system has not evolved as quickly as we would like to see. But I think there are certain reforms already happen. And of course, in terms of opening up and like Professor Yao mentioned earlier, we've built four free trade zones in those four cities. We have more open up and try to attract more foreign investment. I think in terms of those, we've done relatively well. But back to the hukou issue. Our government has a lot of tasks and missions. Of course, in the long run, it has to have significant reforms and have to open up. And in short term, there are a lot of problems we have to face as well, from enterprises, from stock market, from economic slowing down. There are various issues we have to face. So a lot of time, you have to really look into the relationship between reform and development. Of course, you want to push on development. You wish to see more development. But when you have a really huge development, a huge reform, whether it will slow down the economic growth. As an advisor, as a scholar, what we can do is try to analyze the whole situation and try to suggest how can we actually maintain the growth speed and to have reasonable reform at the same time. As I mentioned, in the future, we will have reform dividends, especially for the hukou reform. And that's very obvious. So what kind of outcome we can see in the future? If we can have a reasonably well hukou reform, we will be able to see 1% of the potential economic growth in China. That's very significant, 1%. So based on that analysis, we can say that actually, development and reform are not trade-off. They are they can compensate each other. If you have a more complete, comprehensive reform, you might have a great development at the same time. So I think for the Central Economic Committee, they have mentioned several very important projects in the future that we already identify that we will have a stable economic growth through reforms. Okay, I'd like to respond to your question about economic growth, about Chinese reforms. You mentioned about fair competition in China. Actually, I think we've come a long way and we have huge progress. As we mentioned that we tried to eliminate the negative list, actually we realized this goal by setting up this 4 free trade zone. And currently, China and U.S. are undergoing negotiation to have free trade as well. So what's that mean to China? And not only for the Chinese state-owned enterprises, but also for Chinese private enterprises, they will enjoy the same benefits in the future. And of course, a lot of people were mentioned about state-owned enterprises reform. A lot of foreign enterprises, they have problems, and they think there are great issues with the Chinese state-owned enterprises. They think they do not have any possible ways of entry into those state-owned enterprises. But next step, we're going to see state-owned enterprises reform. We will actually classify them into 2 major categories. One is pure commercially oriented state-owned enterprises, and they will be maintained and managed by the market strategies. The second kind is a charitable state-owned enterprises. What I mean is they are the utility, the providers, state-owned enterprises. So you cannot manage them by the market economy strategies. So for those enterprises which supply water, electricity, and power to China, of course, we have to manage them differently. And In the future, in the past, all the state-owned enterprises are managed by SASAC. But in the future, state-owned enterprises will not be managed directly by a Chinese government. For various enterprises or various stakeholders, they can take part in the management of state-owned enterprises in the future. They can become shareholders. Those are the major reforms we can see in the future. And third point is also mentioned by Professor Tsai earlier. It's about economic reform. Of course, we are going to have our interest rate change. Of course, before, the interest rate has been controlled by the central bank. And basically, we've seen opening up for interest rate and exchange rate. We'd like to see the marketization of exchange rate in the future. Before, we've been pegging the US dollars. And later, we have more fluctuate rates. And from last year, we've changed the mechanism for the whole exchange rate. So every day, central bank have to announce the exchange rate of RMB. It's based on different market makers' price. And this price, of course, the final price, the figure being released will be decided by the central bank. Of course, they have to take into consideration the closing price from previous trading day. So that's our reform in terms of the foreign exchange market. And then we're going to open up more about the capital account.
Actually, I think we have very rapid development in terms of opening up this capital account. And we will see more reforms in the future. Of course, there are risks behind. As you can see, we have huge scales of the capital coming in and out of China. So I think for in terms of financial reform, China is ahead of what we planned to achieve. So I think in the future, we will be able to see more opening up.
Please, can you put up your hand?
Mr. Tsai, I was
改革开放呢，差不多是第一个进入中国的。现在目前还为止还是其中一个的。
I think Hong Kong is one of the region that entered the European market firstly. And for Hong Kong, we are the biggest trading place for RMB. So I would like to ask, in the future, of course, we see China has a lot of open-ups in terms of economic reform, but what do you see in terms of the reform in Hong Kong, especially in related to One Belt, One Road?
Question. And then I'll turn to you. So the lady next to you and then yourself. You put up your hand, didn't you? No, okay, the gentleman here, yeah.
Mansouri from Iran. My question is that the 5 years plan is in a strategic planning process. And in this relation, if we want to have a SWOT analysis for this kind of 5 years planning of China, the weaknesses, strengths, and opportunities and threats, we can see some kind of international challenges for the five-year plans of China. For example, if we see the Chinese Asian Development Bank, it is obviously challenging the IMF system. And in other areas also, if you want to see, you can see the world resources challenges for the big powers in the world. And I want to know in which areas you see China has compatibility with the other competitors like EU or like US, and what challenges you can see for your plan for future. Thank you.
Well, I think you mentioned the word competitor. But you've also mentioned a complementary. I think a complementarity is a better way of describing our relationship than a competition. Because, well, I whatever we say, whatever we do, I think the economic order has been established after the Second World War. And the basic rules have been established in the system. So basically, we have to acknowledge the fact that sometimes the interests of developing countries have been neglected in this older system. So basically, in this world system, there are countries, developing countries, who indeed have concerns that their interests are being neglected. So basically, we have to adjust this system while the world is changing as well. The world is undergoing a very deep change, and the emerging countries and developing countries have been playing ever larger, bigger, important, more important role in the world economy. And basically, I think developed countries and have benefited, and as well as developing countries, we have all benefited from this globalized economy. So basically, we don't need a competition. Every country has to play its role in the cooperative manner. And so in terms of the Chinese, Asian Investment Bank is concerned, well, there is this initiative One Belt One Road. There would basically be a big number of infrastructure investment plan projects, and there is also a need for a financing arm to facilitate the implementation of these projects. We have been trying to be complementary, to play a complementary order, to play a positive role in this world order, in this world system, to have our say, but to play a complementary role. And this is what we have been researching on. This is what we've been talking about. So basically, all in all, I think the being complementary is a much more important term than competition. Well, in terms of the question raised by the friend from Hong Kong, I think Hong Kong could play a very special role in the implementation of the One Belt, One Road initiative. While China, the continental China, has been opening up and been conducting reform, Hong Kong has taught us a lot. And Hong Kong has always been play a very positive role in terms of technology, in terms of services, in terms of financial support. So basically, I think Hong Kong could continue to play this intermediary role between China and the outer world. I think this is for sure. Thank you. Well, as far as Hong Kong is concerned, I think Hong Kong is still a very big financial center and will be very important, crucial for RMB's internationalization. And I think You asked about the challenges that Hong Kong is facing. I think there are challenges, of course. Well, because there is London, there is Singapore, who are also playing a bigger role, an ever larger role in renminbi's internationalization. And there is that poses a problem for Hong Kong. And there is also a certain number of compatibility problem between Hong Kong and the mainland. There is a gap between the price of the renminbi in Hong Kong and some places in the continent, in mainland China. So we have to learn to coordinate more effectively between mainland China and Hong Kong, of course. But as far as I am concerned, I think Hong Kong still has very positive role, very large role, not linguistically, not geographically. But Hong Kong is a very mature financial center, and this center is very much connected to mainland China, to Shanghai. And in terms of a bonds market, there is also a very strong link between Hong Kong and Shanghai and other financial centers in mainland. We're talking about AIB, the Infrastructure Investment Bank. The bank has could also choose Hong Kong as a basis, as a very strong center for its deployment, and this could also be very beneficial for Hong Kong as an international financial center. So this is also, again, complementary.
Thank you very much. Before we bring this session, very interesting session, to a close, I have two questions for both of you as well. We've talked about the opportunities that the new plan opens up for Europeans, European investors, European exporters, European business. There are two things that are actually on the horizon that are, one is weighing in a positive manner, the other is a negative element. The first, of course, is the negotiations on the bilateral investment treaty, and I was wondering if both of you could give me an assessment of how you think this will impact on Europe's status and standing in terms of an important partner for China. And the second, of course, is the discussion, the controversy over the market economy status, and whether you think this will be something that will be, let's say, a negative element in your discussions, your good discussions at the moment with Europe on the future partnership. Please, Professor.
I think you noticed this is...
Yeah, Professor Yao. Yes, I did notice. Thank you very much. Please.
这个关于这个, 中国和欧盟的双边投资条约,
So in terms of the bilateral negotiation between China and EU, we've completed the eighth round. So we've actually evolved very rapidly. And as I mentioned, that we are also working on the bilateral negotiation between China and US. We're already talking about the negative list. But for China and EU, we haven't talked about negative list yet. We're still negotiating about documentation. So no matter what, I think the bilateral treaty between China and US or between China and EU are following the high standard that we've been following, that we hope to achieve this negative list completion very soon. This will benefit greatly for European enterprises and US enterprises. Increase the speed they can enter into Chinese market, because currently we do not have a very comprehensive management way for foreign investors. We only open up these four free trade zones. So how can we achieve it comprehensively in the future? We are still undergoing negotiation. So I think those bilateral negotiations are very important, significant for China, and I hope it's significant for EU as well. Second, you asked about the market economic status. Actually, I think for EU, it did not identify China as a formal market economic
economy. Actually, when we enter into WTO, as you all know that, on Rule 15 and Article number 2, it actually mentioned if Chinese enterprises cannot prove their products have is produced under market economy and cannot survive anti-dumping investigation, and we cannot prove that we're following all the rules. And this article is actually effective for only 15 years, so it will come to expire in 2016. So till this December, this article will be expired. So in the future, when Chinese enterprises facing the investigation of anti-dumping, they have to refer to the price locally rather than the price foreign prices. Because I think we've been situated in the relatively in advantage status in the future, because Chinese products are cheaper. If you want to compare a Chinese goods price with, let's say, Singaporean product price, it's not very fair. Of course, we have a lower price for our products. It's not because we try to have our commercial goods dumping to international markets. So I think this unfavorable situation will end this December, according to this WTO article. Of course, a lot of people are debating is that whether we should grant China a market economy status. That's a major debating point. But if we refer to the articles of WTO, no matter for EU or US, whether they recognize China as a market economic status or not, I think when they try to investigate into the prices of our products, they cannot compare our product prices with other countries' product prices. So after 1st of December this year, I think we have to review product prices and to review the market economy of status of China differently. So some people would argue that from December 1st this year, we can view China as a market economy status. But I think personally, whether you ratify China this market economic status is more politically rather than economically. If you identify China with market economic status before December 1st, I think maybe you actually ratify us from economic point of view. If you recognize China, identified it with market economic status after December, as I said, I think it's more point of view, more politically. Because for the open ups and reforms from since 78, we've been focusing on building a market economy, especially in 92. In the documents set up by the Central Committee, that we've been focusing on building China into a market economy. We complete quite a lot of them. And in the 13th five-year plan, we have more guidelines to help us or guide us onto this market economy. So I think, as you can see, we've been doing really hard on our part to help China to transform into market economy. So for Chinese enterprises, I think we do recognize those enterprises as players in the market economy. So, of course, we've seen a lot of debates from EU, from the States, and they have different interpretation to different various articles. But I think whether you identify China with its market economy status, I said
a lot of time it's not economically judgment, but politically judgment. So we would like to see EU ratify China with its market economy status in the near future.
Thank you very much indeed. Whether that happens or not, I think it's still a moot point. The jury's still out. The EU is still discussing it. But whatever happens, I think EU-China trade is so important. It's too important to be jeopardized or endangered by something that affects only 1 to 2% of global trade. I think DG Trade would agree to that, and I think the EU would agree to that, and I hope China does as well. Thank you very much indeed, both professors, for coming over. Thank you to the Chinese mission for bringing them over. I think we've had a very stimulating, informative discussion on the new plan. You've opened up our eyes to some of the elements that perhaps we were not very, very aware of. It's going to be a long and challenging journey for China, and of course the only thing I can say is China matters, and we'll be watching you, and we'll be wishing you luck. We wish you luck. So thank you very much indeed to all participants for coming. As you know, our EU-China discussions continue throughout the year, and you'll be kept informed. And Young China Watchers, welcome again, and thank you for being here.